Munchery makes it easy to eat well, no matter how busy you are. Their fresh, healthy, ready-to-eat meals are cooked from scratch each morning using local ingredients, then delivered right to your door. Order a delicious dinner just for tonight or schedule convenient weekly deliveries. With Munchery, there's an option for every appetite. Visit Munchery.com to save 50% off your first order using the code AXE50.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Seems like just yesterday that I was in the back of a van with Bernie Sanders in Chicago recording the first episode of The Axe Files. And here we are today, the 200th episode of The Axe Files. And I just want to thank all of you who have been faithful listeners of these conversations. Today's is of particular interest because Ed Gillespie, the Republican who lost the Virginia governor's race in November, a particularly heated and controversial governor's race, sat down for his first conversation since that campaign to talk about some of the controversial decisions that he made in the campaign, some of the advertisements that got a great deal of attention, and perhaps contributed to the wave of voters who helped elect the Democrat Ralph Northam to the State House. But that race was merely the coda on a long and interesting career in public life. The reason that Ed sits on the board of the Institute of Politics. And we had a chance to talk about the entire journey in this conversation. Ed Gillespie, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Lot to talk about, and obviously you've had an interesting year, and we want to talk about that. But before we get there, I want to talk about the journey to that year and start with the fact I have something in common, that we both are the sons of immigrants. Tell me about your folks.
My father came to this country as a boy from Ireland. He was 8 years old, and his grandfather had found work in America, and my grandfather was a janitor. He worked at a big bank building in Philadelphia, and he'd go in after the bank closed, 6 o'clock at night. He'd start an 8-hour shift, and he'd start on the ground floor emptying the waste baskets and mopping the floors, and over the course of an 8-hour shift, he'd work his way to the top story, and the last thing he would do would be to polish the big wooden conference table in the boardroom and get home around 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. My parents didn't go to college, neither one, two of the smartest and hardest working people I've ever known. They worked on their feet all day in a grocery store. The J&C Market and J&C were Jack and Connie, and that was my mom and dad. It was a mom-and-pop grocery store, and in my family, when you turned 12, you got a birthday cake and a present and a four-hour shift at the J&C Market. We all worked in that grocery store.
Your dad was a veteran as well, right?
He was decorated, World War II infantry leader. Both my parents are laid to rest in a veterans cemetery, and my father, two Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and a Silver Star in World War II. 29th Infantry, and I always say Jack Gillespie was born in Donegal, Ireland, but he died a great American, and he instilled that in us. And I believe to this day that people who come here legally and become Americans are patriotic Americans, and first generation Americans, very patriotic. And we've seen the blessings of liberty in this country and my family.
Your folks were Democrats.
Yeah.
Your mom ran for the school board, is that right?
Yeah, the first race I ever worked on was when I was 9 years old, and my mother was the first woman ever elected to the school board in our town. And so she shattered a glass ceiling, was a trailblazer, and then she
became president of the school board.
And became president of the school board, and she served, I think, about 12 years on the school board.
And did she talk about why she wanted – I mean, do you remember her talking about why she wanted to do it?
Well, I'm one of six children, and she had six children in the public schools, and I think she was concerned about the schools. We weren't a political family. My father was, as being a grocer, and standing behind that grocery store counter. People would come in and out of the store all day long, and they would ask him what he thought about different races and that kind of thing.
Better than being a pollster.
It is, and he had a pretty good political sense.
He also ran a tavern as well, right?
I always say, you know, he lived every Irishman's dream. Eventually, he sold the store and he bought a bar.
You get some opinions there as well.
A shot and a beer kind of place. There was no tap. You know, it was all just long neck. I always say you could get a mixed drink if all the ingredients were in the name of the drink. You know, 7 and 7 we could make. A vodka and orange juice, we could make that. But it was a very working class family. And we cared about and were interested in politics. They were Democrats. And I was born a Democrat. If you're Irish and Catholic, born in New Jersey in 1961, the year John F. Kennedy is sworn in, they all but stamp it on your birth certificate. Over time, my father became
an independent. Picture of JFK up in the saloon?
JFK in the house at our home, a picture of JFK and Pope John.
The 23rd.
Seeds of peace. Yeah. And so that was the culture that I grew up in. My father became an independent, registered independent, and couldn't bring himself to be a Republican, but he grew disenchanted with the Democratic Party under Jimmy Carter. And he found Reagan very appealing, like a lot of ethnic Democrats in the Midwest and the Northeast, you know, in 1980 and 84.
You went off to you went to Washington to go to college at Catholic University.
I did. And it wasn't my intention. I was originally wanted to go to school in New England, but I got rejected and ended up in Washington, D.C. at Catholic University, which is where I was meant to be. And I worked my way through school. I took out student loans and I parked cars.
At the Senate.
Senate parking lot.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up getting into politics. I actually wanted to go into journalism and was going to study. And I was studying communications and journalism, and I was the sports editor at the school paper.
Right about sports, I saw that. Yeah, yeah. And so, so did the parking of cars at the Senate expose you to people who looked after you, gave you opportunities? How did that all happen?
It did. One of the guys I was parking cars with, and the neat thing about parking cars there, it's students from all the different colleges from around the District of Columbia. And so you got to meet, kids from Georgetown and American and Howard and Catholic and Trinity. And that was very interesting. And one of them had an internship in one of the offices on the House side and said, there's another internship available. It's a good office. You should intern there. So I applied for the internship, and that led to a job, and that led to another job and another job.
And you went to work for a congressman from Florida.
Who was a Democrat. Andy Ireland.
Yes.
And I thought that was perfect fit
for you.
But he became a Republican in the realignment. You know, in 1984, he ran as a Republican and changed parties. And that's when I, you know, became a Republican.
And then you took that communications interest of yours and you applied it to politics. You went to work for Dick Armey, who became quite an influential figure in the shift in the Republican Party.
He was a freshman member of Congress who was elected in 1984.
From Texas.
A big landslide year, obviously, for President Reagan and a lot of coattails. And 6 Republican freshman members of Congress were elected in Texas that year, and they called them the Texas Six-Pack. And I wanted to be a press secretary, and because of my interest in journalism, and I could write pretty well. But there wasn't an opening in the office in Andy Ireland's office, and so someone that I knew told me about this opening in Dick Armey's office, and I, you know, applied there and got the job, and went to work for him in his first month in office. He was an economics professor from University of North Texas, conservative, free market conservative, and, you know, really driven by ideas. And we clicked, and he had a very good office. And, you know, he kind of became a force of nature in the House.
Became head of the House Republican Conference.
He ultimately became head of the House Republican Conference. But really kind of what made his name was he passed the base closure bill, the Base Closing and Realignment Act, and that's still in effect today. That is the process by which we determine what bases, military bases, to keep open or close or consolidate.
Which is as sensitive
a
process as there can be, because communities rely on those bases for economic reasons, and so they fight hard to keep him, whether it makes sense or not.
Well, and that's he was trying to remove that decision-making process from the political thicket and have it be a less political process, and that's what the Base Closing and Realignment Commission does. It's still very political, and it has a huge impact, obviously, and people try to affect it, but it's not as affected as if it were just a decision made by members of Congress earmarking and that kind of thing. I remember during the course of that debate, Bob Dole, who obviously has a great sense of humor, told a story about a base closure when he was a freshman House member, and he got a call from the senator from Kansas who said they're closing a base. Or Dole called the senator because he got notice that they were closing the base in his district, and he said, "Do you want to announce this with me?" And the senator said to him, "No, I only announce base openings." It's a very, you know, it has an impact,
yeah,
obviously.
Right.
And so the to move it out of the political spectrum and into a more rational decision-making process has had a long-term beneficial effect net to the country. But it's, you know, it's caused pain in certain communities, obviously.
You met your wife during this period. She, too, was working on the Hill.
She was, and working for a Texas member, and we had a softball team for the Texas offices, and we met playing softball in a congressional softball league, and I went out to a practice, and she was pitching, and someone handed me a bat and said, "Why don't you, take some licks?" And so I went up to home plate, and I looked out on the mound, and there she was, and that was it. I truly felt like a lightning bolt.
How'd you do at the plate there? I
took her deep. But we've been married 30 years now.
I know she worked for Joe Barton.
She did.
And what was your, you must have known him well. Were you, you must have been shocked by his demise?
Yeah, I was, surprised by it.
Political demise, I should say.
Yeah.
He's still with us.
You know, I have, you know, he came in, he was part of that Texas six pack, and Kathy was his first, employee, essentially. She was at Texas A&M, and she basically ran his campaign out of her college apartment, and was his first paid employee. It was for a special election to replace Phil Graham when he had run for the Senate, for Tower Senate seat. And so it was an interesting race. And but, I always feel that one of the biggest risks in Washington, and in particular in the House, is people staying too long. And I like Joe, and I think he served the people of the 6th District well. But I think, to my mind, this is one of the things that happens when someone stays too long. And a friend of mine, I mentioned Robert Hurt, who's a member of Congress from Virginia, and he called me after serving for, I think, three terms, maybe four, couple years ago, and said, I'm not going to run for re-election. And I said, good for you. I said, I think that's great. You served honorably. You're going home. That's what the founders had in mind. And, you served the people of the 5th District very well. Your boys are still young enough where you the time you spend with them is important, and I'm happy for you. And he's, doing a public affairs program at Liberty University now, and he loves it. And I think that if more of the members of the House in particular, but it's true of the Senate as well, were to come and then leave after a certain period on their own terms, just too many of these folks get carried out on their shields because they stay too long.
Barton was caught up in this really cultural sea change that's starting. I mean, it was disclosed that he had sent some photos that were inappropriate, and what do you make of all of this, and where is it going to lead? Because these charges go right up to the president of the United States.
Well, I think, in fairness to Joe, and these are distinctions that it's kind of unbelievable to me that these are the distinctions we're making in this conversation, but in his case, these were adult women, largely his age, that he was engaged in extramarital affairs with, but they were consensual. And, that's a distinction, I think, between someone who is engaged in a relationship with someone in a subordinate position or harassing, sexually harassing employees or staff, or harassing even those who are not employees or staff, and it's not consensual. And, you know, these are the conversations, it is clear to me, seems right now, we're going to be having for a while.
And maybe some of it we should, I mean, because it isn't just limited to politics, but also business, Hollywood.
Oh,
we've
yeah.
seen it. We've seen examples in all these places where people, men in positions of power abuse it in ways that are untoward.
Yes.
But it just, it's someone told me, I won't repeat the number, but someone suggested to me the numbers of members of Congress who may fall into this category and are at risk is quite high.
Significant. And, there's a lot that is going on right now. It is a significant cultural moment. I have two young daughters.
I know one of them.
Yes.
Great young woman.
Very bright and, entering the workforce. And I have to admit that I've been stunned by the number of people who have engaged in that. I've been very fortunate, I think, apparently I've been fortunate in the circumstances in which I've worked in that, and I've pressed myself. I suspect everyone has. You know, have I seen this in my workforces and in offices where I've worked? And I really can't think of instances of this kind of harassment. And I've prided myself in my own businesses and working with women, in promoting them and treating them with respect. And I've been amazed at how rampant this is. And I do think that it's a moment that is going to result in change that is much for the better for my daughters and for future generations of women.
We can't leave this without me asking you a couple of obvious questions. One is about the president himself, and there are all these numbers of women who have stepped forward and accused him of harassment at a minimum. Nikki Haley, the ambassador of the United Nations, said this past weekend, these women should be taken seriously. They should be heard. What's your feeling about that, and what message does it send? And we can go back. Look, we can have an honest discussion about there are Democratic presidents who who've been guilty of things that in today's world would not have been tolerated.
Yeah.
But what's your view of it?
I believe these women, relative to the president, will be heard. And the question is, well, in what venue and to what end? I don't know the answers to that, but I suspect we're going to hear more from them, as we're going to hear more from women who have been affected in the workplace and more in Hollywood and more on Capitol Hill and in other venues. Now, you see in a situation with Senator Franken, you see with...
Who resigned.
Who resigned. Representative Franks. There are others. Joe Barton said he's not going to seek re-election. There are others whose names have been put forward. Representative Conyers, obviously. And each of them are in different situations to a certain extent, and how you get to a certain extent justice or fairness in that process, I think is going to be different in these different venues. To your point about the women affecting the president, being heard, I think they're going to be heard. Where does that?
If those charges are proven, or presumably the same kinds of things apply here as elsewhere. They may have talked to people contemporaneously about it and so on. What then? What happens?
I don't know.
Should the president also resign, as the others have resigned?
If it turns out,
if those things are true, should the president resign?
He has said that they're not true.
Right.
And, this
it's kind
is
kind of a weird thing, though. If you deny it, you can go on. If you acknowledge it, you resign, it's kind of a perverse incentive, you know.
Again,
perverse,
I think
it's not the right word here. But.
Yeah, but this is, I think because, look, we're in uncharted waters here to a certain extent. And I think these things are going to play themselves out in a way that it's hard to be predictive right now.
You are a former chair of the RNC.
Yes.
The RNC is now supporting, as we sit here today, the race will be tomorrow, Roy Moore in Alabama. Do you think the RNC should be supporting Moore? And what will it mean if he gets elected?
If I were an Alabaman, I would not be able to bring myself to vote for Roy Moore. I couldn't vote for Doug Jones, but I wouldn't be able to bring myself to vote for him. Now, the Cory Gardner has at the senatorial
chairman
committees,
of the chairman the of DSCC, the senatorial committee, senator from Colorado,
NRSC, has they're not
putting, yes right
yeah they're Sorry. Not putting money into the race. I think that's, you know, that's the right decision.
And what if he gets elected? Should he be seated?
Again, uncharted waters. I mean, this is
it bad for the Republican Party either way?
You know, I think given what Senator Franken has done and Conyers and we'll see what others, there are some other Democrats, you know, obviously who are in the mix. You know, politically, I think that it's obviously going to be a challenge. And I think the members of the Senate Republican Conference realize that. They've made that clear. I was struck by Senator Shelby and his comments yesterday.
The senior senator from Alabama said he could not, he didn't vote
he voted,
for,
he wrote in someone
voted
else.
For Roy Moore. But I'm trying to think through the politics of this. So everybody's now saying, well, let the people of Alabama decide. The people of Alabama decide. And then he comes to the Senate, and then the Senate expels him with the president of the United States supporting him?
I don't know. Like I say, I mean, and I've seen the statements, various statements from leaders in the Senate. You know, they said there'll be an immediate investigation, an ethics investigation. And so that would run its course, I assume. Again, uncharted, you know, territory here.
But just putting your strategist hat on, and you're one of the best, doesn't it create an enormous problem with the base of this sort of Trump base of the Republican Party if Moore comes and then is expelled, and presumably with a lot of Democratic votes to expel him as well as some Republicans?
Well, there are these tensions and these cross currents clearly, and it's true in both parties, as you know. But this is an example where there will be a segment of the electorate that will say, you know, we're electing someone. There was an interesting piece, I wish I could remember and give proper credit, that I saw not too long ago that kind of talked about the difference between one of the differences between the elites and kind of rank and file voters, whether they be in the Democratic or the liberal base of either party. And it said the mentality is, look, we're not electing someone. The elites may see it as, well, we're, you know, we have to be more virtuous and role models and that kind of thing. A lot of the electorate is saying, we're just sending somebody there to do a job and to vote for tax cuts and conservative judges and, you know,
well,
other
in fact, some
other
of those
issues.
Voters clearly resent being told that
and
they
there's, and
vote
that, and that's a factor as well. There is a sense that, you know, people from outside of our you know, state or commonwealth, in my case, you know, we don't want folks telling us what we, you know, who we can and cannot vote for. We'll make that decision ourselves. And there's a backlash that results from that. But I'm not minimizing the challenge. I'm agreeing with you that but these are some of the factors that contribute to it.
Before we leave this, is it better for the Republican Party to take the hit and have a Democrat hold that seat for however long that Democrat does, or to deal with having Roy Moore with all of his, and it's not just about his sexual harassment, but about, you know, his comments on slavery and a whole range of other things.
In my view, just politically, I've made clear my own view in terms of, as a person, I could not vote for him. Mm-hmm. From a political perspective, I don't think the you know, the long-term pain would be worth the short-term gain of the seat politically. But again, I don't, you know, my view as a Virginian is not going to have much of an impact, you know, in that regard.
Let's take a short break and we'll be right back with Ed Gillespie.
The right sheets can take your sleep and your style to the next level. With Boll & Branch, the upgrade has never been more affordable. Every set is crafted from 100% organic cotton. They get softer and softer over time. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews, and even three U.S. presidents have Boll & Branch sheets. Try them for 30 nights, and if you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. Go to BollandBranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free U.S. shipping with promo code AXE, spelled B-O-L-L and Branch.com. That's BollandBranch.com, promo code AXE.
I want to return to your story. So Dick Armey, as we talked about, became one of the leaders of the sort of what was known as, it may actually aggravate him to hear it said this way, but the Gingrich Revolution,
right,
in 1994. And a linchpin of that campaign in 94 when the Republicans took over the House was something called the Contract with America.
Right.
You were deeply involved in drafting that. Tell me about that.
You know, it was a very exciting time, and Gingrich deserves a lot of credit, as does Armey. The two of them, when they came together, really formed an alliance that was pretty powerful, and their ability to work together and the staffs to work together, was something that we hadn't really seen. Armey got into leadership and became conference chairman of the House Republican Conference, and Newt was the whip. And they both believed very strongly that opposing President Clinton was not enough, that you had to come forward with a competing alternative agenda for governance. And they worked very hard in that regard to put forward 10 bills that they would, if Republicans took control of the House, which, remember, at that point had not been the case for 40 years,
right,
for four decades.
No, it was a tectonic shifting of the plates.
It was. But they felt that that was the necessary ingredient that had been missing, was to not just run against President Clinton or run with a Republican presidential candidate, but to come forward and say, this is what we'll do if we're given the ability to govern and the responsibility of governing. So they went about bringing together the whole House Republican Conference and candidates for Congress all across the country to craft an agenda that they could run on in a unified way and say, we'll do this. And that was the genesis for the Contract with America. And I was involved in the drafting of it. I co-authored the book, Contract with America, and I gave the names to the bills in the contract as part of kind of the marketing campaign. And it was very effective. This was before social media, and so the media kind of hook on it was an ad in a TV Guide, and where you could tear it out. It was like a cardboard cardstock insert that you could tear out, and the point was, this is the contract, keep it. And keep, you know, tabs on us and see if we'll do these 10 things and hold us accountable. And it was a very successful effort.
Yeah, it's unusual for a legislative party to be able to craft. And ever since, there's always been this, well, when Republicans are out or when Democrats, why can't there be a coherent? I mean, usually it takes a president to shape an agenda. That was an unusual.
It was unusual, and I do think we were at a point, because we'd been out for 40 years, and we'd had 3 years of Republican presidencies, because we had President Reagan elected, reelected, and then President Bush for a third term,
yes,
essentially. And so the truth is, and it's the natural cycle, but by the end of that third Republican presidency, we'd gotten a little flat, and that was, and President Clinton was able to take advantage of that, obviously, to get elected. And so then this was a way to say, here's some new ideas, some new blood, some things that, you know, that we haven't talked about in a while.
Let me just ask you one thing about the whole period of time. Gingrich was a very sharp-edged character,
yeah,
and he went hard after some of the leadership that had been there, Bob Michael, who was the Republican leader there, who he ultimately replaced and so on. And part of it was a much more aggressive stance toward Democrats. And, you know, I mean, I, for one, and I know Newt and, you know, we've had delightful conversations, yeah. Not always agreeing. But it seems like there was a point of departure there where our politics in Washington got very, very sort of hard-edged. And so rather than thinking of opponents across the aisle as colleagues who with whom you have disagreements, it became much more sort of take no prisoners and so on. Is that a fair assessment?
In some ways, yes. I would say you could go back a little further, though. To me, in terms of my experience, I actually think the rejection of John Tower as Secretary of Defense and
in the 80s.
In the 80s was kind of an initial harbinger of some of that, and a little bit of a break from the kind of traditional. You know, that to me was kind of a watershed moment.
And some of the Supreme Court fights.
And then some of the court fights, obviously. Mm-hmm. Bork, you know, mm-hmm. being a significant one in that regard, too. So, you know, it's kind of a question, well, who started it? I do think that Gingrich took those tactics and aggressively applied them as well. And he used media. You know, he was... He kind of saw C-SPAN as an opportunity when the House floor opened up to C-SPAN as an opportunity to get a message.
For these one-minute messages.
The 1 minutes and the special orders.
It takes vision to see C-SPAN as a weapon,
yeah,
I must say.
It does. But there's no doubt there was a sharpening of the differences, and he wanted to highlight the differences.
Do you look back and say that wasn't all for the good?
You know, I'll tell you, not because when we took control of the House, there were still, you know, good working relationships across the aisle. And you still had, you know, bipartisan support. It you know, things have, the polarization has accelerated throughout the years. And I would say that was a moment of acceleration. But again, to my mind, I would go back to the confirmations of Tower and Bork. And some other things that
Thomas. Although that one takes on a new dimension in today's context.
But that's why I think Bork is maybe a more apt example. And you know, it did accelerate it. But whether or not it was a reflection of, you know, or a cause, you know, it may have been a reflection of what was going on in the electorate. Republicans were very frustrated, having been out of power for 40 years, and felt that, you know, the things that we'd been doing weren't resulting in any change, and that we had to do things differently. And, you know, Newt applied that with his approach to sharpen the differences. But to his credit, I would say, in that regard, too, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with sharpening differences, but he did put forward these 10 bills and say it's about the policy. These are our policies that we will, you know, that we will enact. And the contract with America and the 94 midterm was not just about President Clinton. It was about these policies.
You've held many different positions in politics and out of politics. In the 90s and 2000s, you established yourself as a lobbying presence in town, and first with Haley Barbour, former DNC RNC chair, and the former and I guess he became governor of Mississippi
after
all of that, and then with Jack Quinn, who had been counsel to Vice President Gore, and you guys represented some of the sort of blue chip corporations in America, including banks, tobacco companies, and so on. Say a word about lobbyists, and if you want to say a kind word about them, because there's a real jaundice in this country about the impact that lobbyists have had.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. And look, I to my view, as a conservative Republican, you know, I wish that the federal government did not have the effect on the economy and the direct impact on the economy that it does in many, many different ways. But it does, clearly. And people have a right to petition their government And so trade associations, charitable foundations and others, corporate America hire people to represent their interests before the government and the Congress. And it's become a big industry. There's no two ways about it. And, you know, one of the things that, Jack and I did, obviously, in forming Quinn Gillespie was to form a bipartisan firm to try to find ways to help serve clients on both sides of the aisle. At the time, it was somewhat unique, not entirely unique, but somewhat unique. And, you know, we took on folks who had big problems and tough challenges and, tried to apply the things that we had learned in government and in campaigns about how to promote ideas and, you know, deliver message and, you know, make it clear that this was a good thing, not just for this company, but, you know, why it would be good for the broader public, whether it's job creation or innovation.
One of the complaints is that people come in and out of government. You see a lot of an influx of a lot of lobbyists. Now, you were in and out of government in the 2000s. And you, for example, and tell me if this is wrong.
Yeah.
But you were influential in sort of thinking through appointments to the FCC when Bush became president. You'd represented telecommunications companies. Is that right?
No, I can't recall. I didn't really make personnel. There are folks who do that. I never lobbied on personnel because I didn't feel comfortable doing that. I lobbied on issues. I know a lot of the people who, mm-hmm. you know, who ended up in a lot of those positions, but I don't recall
advocating
for somebody.
But the reason I ask this is that this is sort of the swamp that
right.
President Trump
yes.
Talked about, this sort of relation. And now it seems like that it has come back sort of with a vengeance. Lots of lobbyists there, and the question is, I guess what you're saying is that you think the government has too much power and therefore lobbyists who try and influence it have a great deal of power too?
I don't know that they have a great deal of power. My point is, you know, I would prefer an economy where Washington weren't so central to the economic, you know, direction of the country. But it is. And, you know, people have a right, literally a constitutional right, to you know, make their case to the government. By the way, people also do that through grassroots and through, you know, town hall meetings and going to their member of Congresses.
But if you were Jack Gillespie,
yeah,
tavern owner,
yeah,
you would not have the influence that Philip Morris has when they hire Ed Gillespie.
He wouldn't, but he was a member of NFIB. Mm-hmm. And you know, he paid dues to NFIB and was proud of his membership as a small business owner in the NFIB, and they've got, you know, influence.
It's a national lobby for small business.
Right, National Federation of Independent Businesses. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, it's we tried to do work on behalf of clients that we, you know, were proud of and on issues that we felt were, you know, were good, but we obviously, it was our business. No two ways about it. And when I left what became QGA to go to work for President Bush in the White House, you know, I had to sever all ties and I did not, you know, return to lobbying. Not because I think it's bad, but I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoy some other things that I do. And but we were very effective on behalf of our clients, and we did a good job for them.
You mentioned your service with President George W. Bush. In fact, you and I had parallel positions in the White House.
Yeah.
I've mentioned before, I was always grateful that you, in the transition, were very open and invited me over, and as was President Bush toward President Obama. George W. Bush, when I think of him, you know, I think of a guy who is pro-trade, was a real advocate for immigration reform. He believed in America's leadership role in the world, you know, and I'm leaving out aside the wars, which were decisions I'm sure he took, thinking they were part of that leadership in the world. And we could debate that for a long time, whether that was the right or wrong decision. But it's striking how far the Republican Party under President Trump has moved from those positions. And, you know, you ran for governor in this past year. In 2014, you ran against Senator Warner. You almost beat him.
Yeah.
It was the most stunning race of 2014. Nobody thought you had a chance, including a lot of Republican donors who didn't give you the money that you probably needed to win. You lost by a point or a little more than a point.
8/10 of a percentage point. Not that anyone's counting.
Yes. You probably know the exact number. But 2017, you're running for governor, and you almost lose a primary for governor. You are as established a figure in Virginia Republican politics as there is. A former chairman of the Virginia Party, the consensus choice, or at least thought to be for governor. And part of it was that you are a George W. Bush Republican, an establishment Republican. How stunning was that to find yourself in that position?
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, in 14, I was outspent, you know, by over $10 million because Republicans didn't think I had any chance to win. In 17, in the governor's race, I was outspent by $10 million because Democrats thought I could. And, you know, I was supposed to lose the Senate race by 9 points, and it was a neck-and-neck race. I was supposed to be in a neck-and-neck race in the governor's contest in this last November and lost by 9 points. You know, I mean, it's just so unpredictable. And it was unpredictable in terms of the primary, the closeness of it. I had made a conscious decision for it to be a closer contest than I didn't think it was going to be that close. But I did not, you know, kind of go at my, and I had two opponents, and that contributed to it as well, because the third opponent took a, you know, his votes would have been my votes.
But your principal challenger, the one you barely beat, was Corey Stewart. Who had been so outspoken that he's actually expelled from the Trump campaign, which is hard, really hard to do.
And I chose to not, you know, kind of attack him or to you know, do any negative against him. And also, frankly, not to spend that much money to shepherd my resources and to husband my campaign dollars for the general, not because I was just taking it for granted. You know, we had data that showed that we were in better shape than we were. But again, that's one of the things. The data is very unreliable these days, and it's hard to model the electorate in an off year primary.
Yeah, I think that we should explain that polling is only as good as the models, and if your model is off in terms of your assumptions as to who's going to show up, your polling can be off too. And that was true in some of the state polling in 2016.
Exactly. And a lot more of the people who had come out to vote in the Republican primary in Virginia for President Trump in the primary came out to vote again the next year in the gubernatorial contest, which we were not anticipating them coming back. And they did. And that resulted in a much closer race because my opponent was, you know, the running on Trump. I was running on my own set of issues that I thought were more relevant, frankly, to Virginia in terms of the policies that we needed.
Mostly on economics. We're going to take another break, and we'll be right back with Ed Gillespie. Just to back up for a second, you never endorsed Donald Trump for president.
When he became the nominee, I did. And I'm a former RNC chairman, and I said I would support our nominee, and I did. And in fact, I introduced Vice President Pence, then Governor Pence, at a couple of rallies in Virginia.
But you weren't seen by the Trump base in Virginia as a Trump person, for that. That's fair to say. It seems to me that this primary, Ed, in Virginia really spoke to the sort of ongoing, I don't know if you call it a civil war, but within the Republican Party. And they're really very different. I mean, there may be some commonality on issues of regulation and tax cuts and so on, but on these issues that really propel Trump, trade, immigration, the sort of the social divide, it seems pretty profound. And your primary race spoke to that.
Well, the fact is, I would have every day in the course of my campaign, three Republicans would say to me, "You've got to stand up to President Trump." And every day, three Republicans would say, "You've got to stand up for President Trump." And my mentality was, I'm not running to be for or against President Trump. I'm running to be for the, people of Virginia to be our next governor. And I really wanted to keep the focus on that.
Almost impossible, though, isn't it?
Well, to your point, if you're not, standing up for President Trump, for his supporters, they see you as not for him. And it's not that I was not for him. It's just that, I'm not against him. I wanted to be for Virginia, and I wanted to keep the focus on Virginia.
That's such a hard tightrope to walk.
It's a tough tightrope to walk, and it may not be walkable, to be honest with you.
Yeah. He was in the state a lot because he has his golf club there. He tends to stay at his property, so he was in the state a lot. He never campaigned for you. I presume that you never asked him to campaign for you. Is that right?
That's correct. And it was a point of discussion. The president did not ask to campaign. He did not ask to come in. I know everybody thought about it. Remember, the president didn't carry Virginia,
right? And highly unpopular in Northern Virginia.
And Northern Virginia, where the a third of the population. And we had concluded that we didn't want to nationalize the race. I wanted the race to be about Virginia. And that's, by the way, the norm in our Virginia governor's contest. When you have, the first – and New Jersey has a race too, but there wasn't much of a race there. And so all mm-hmm. the chips were on the table in Virginia. All the focus was on Virginia. And as the 10 of the last gubernatorial elections in the year following the presidential election have gone to the party out of power, out of the White House.
Right.
And the exception was with President Obama.
2013 was the outlier.
And
Terry McAuliffe.
And it was largely an outlier again because of an external factor, which was the government shutdown, which took place for the first 16 days of October, which I think had a big impact in terms of that outcome, or it may have gone consistent with the norm. So I knew it was going to be, a challenge election day.
When you started to run, your assumption was probably that Hillary Clinton was going to be president.
Well, that was the conventional wisdom. Now I was going to run regardless, but I looking at all the polling and everything, like we just said, turned out to be wrong. That was my... that was my guess, was that she was likely to win based on what I was seeing. So I knew on the day after the election, the presidential election, that the road just became a lot harder given the historic pattern in Virginia.
Well, and the fact that, as you said earlier, that Trump was a divisive figure even within the Republican Party. So there were Republicans who probably were very vehemently embracing of him, and Republicans who were recoiling from him.
And I was able to bring them all together. If you look at the exit surveys, the fact is I got, I think, 95% of self-identified Republicans, which is, what you get when you've got a unified party. Nobody gets 100% even of their own party. I think Lieutenant Governor, now Governor, like Northam, was right around the same with Democrats. And we also had record high turnout.
Yeah.
That was the most votes.
You did very well with independents when you ran for the Senate in 2014.
Yeah.
Not so much in 2017.
I carried them in 17, but 50-48 narrow margin. But we got, we turned out our vote, and so I was able to unify the party and not constantly talking about it. I just had made a determination. I wanted to talk about my policies about Virginia and not get sucked into the national debate as best as I could avoid it.
But it's not easy. But look, you know that I have to ask you about how you unified the party, because the fact is that you're the object of suspicion among the Trump base that was and there was a concern that they weren't going to come out. In the fall, you embarked on a series of ads that are very controversial. One about Ralph Northam, your opponent, who you, I know you've been friendly with him over the years. You told me in advance of the race, I think it'll be a very gentlemanly race. But these weren't very gentlemanly ads. But, I mean, Harold Washington, my old Klein in Chicago, you say politics ain't beanbag. Well, that this is certainly an example of that. But you ran ads around the issue after Charlottesville of the Confederate statues, and the implication of the ad was local communities should decide. You yourself had said that you thought these statues might. Correct me if I'm wrong. Should perhaps come down, but you think it should be up to local communities?
No, let's talk about the statues for a second. It's an important issue, and there's so many misperceptions about it. So the reason it became an issue after Charlottesville is because my opponent, Governor-elect Northam, came out and said all the statues should come down. And he and I both agreed that it should be a local decision, that the locality should decide. But my view was that they should not all come down, that we should add historical context to them. By the way, that's an opinion that's shared by the current governor, Terry McAuliffe, and former governor Doug Wilder. So rather than take them all down, add historical context. I wouldn't, if I were a city council or county board of supervisors, spend the money to take them down, because it's an expensive proposition. And on top of that, there's a lot of misperception. People don't understand, because they saw the coverage from Charlottesville, and people outside Virginia believe that the statues are all of Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson or Jefferson Davis. They're not. The statues that people really care most about all around Virginia in city squares and county courthouses are to an anonymous soldier. And they commemorate the soldiers who served and fought and died in the Civil War from that county or that city, and they're anonymous. There's one in Old Town on Prince Street and Washington, and they're 100 years old, and they're landmarks, and you know, people don't support taking them down, and in fact, in the exit survey, in an electorate that was a plus 11 Democratic electorate, 60% said they thought that the statue should remain up.
But the ad you ran kind of caught the zeitgeist of the president's position on this. And then there were two other ads that you ran that were more controversial. One of them that was kind of a classic. Having made ads, I recognize the style. But it was a pretty inflammatory ad linking Northam to MS-13, which is a gang that has had a presence in Virginia, and the issue of sanctuary cities, because he cast a deciding vote for a bill that would allow communities to become sanctuary. That would
he cast a vote against a bill that would have banned communities from becoming sanctuary cities.
Right. But there are no sanctuary cities.
Correct. I always said
in Virginia. Yeah. But the ad didn't say that. The ad implied that somehow there was a link between that vote and the activities of MS-13. And, I know how you feel about immigrants, because as we started off talking, we're both the children of immigrants. Did you then, or do you have now, any regrets about having run that ad?
The ad was about a vote that was cast on the floor of our state Senate. In the same way, by the way, the statues became an issue when my opponent took a position for taking them all down. That's why it became an issue. Most Virginians do not agree with that. By the way, in the Washington Post poll, 44% of African Americans in Virginia said they support taking the statues down. 40% of African Americans favor keeping them up. But let me go back. So my point is, these are policy positions. My opponent cast a vote on the floor of the Senate, a deciding vote against a ban. And that bill would have allowed cities or counties to not cooperate with federal immigration authorities to deport someone here illegally who commits a violent crime. MS-13 largely is here illegally, and they terrorize the immigrant community themselves. And so my point is that will not make us safer when someone who is here, and by the way, from November to November, for the year prior to the election, there have been 8 MS-13-related gang murders in Northern Virginia alone.
They have nothing
alone.
To do with sanctuary cities, though.
I didn't say that they have anything to do with sanctuary cities, but we should be able to deport them if they are arrested, was the point, and that his policy would not make us safer, would make it harder for us to crack down on MS-13.
If any community actually qualified as sanctuary cities and took the position that they wouldn't turn over people who committed
Correct.
Violent crimes. So
Correct.
There's several steps to go there. I mean, as I said, you and I, we've both been in yeah. tough campaigns. We've both, I mean, I think back at the ads I've done over yeah. the years, and you know, you take, you shade, you take liberties, they're defensible. On the sort of as you're defending your app, but you know what you're doing. You're inflaming people.
Well, it's not meant to inflame people. And in fact, one of the things we saw was the people I was trying to get to were suburban women who had have a legitimate concern about public safety. And MS-13 is a menace in Northern Virginia. You'll just read the news coverage. And in fact, there was a fact check, David, on one of my statements. I said there were 2,000 MS-13 gang members in Northern Virginia or in Fairfax County. And the Post did a fact check. They said there was 1,400. There's 2,000 gang members. 1,400 of them are MS-13. Well, that's more MS-13 gang members than Fairfax County police officers.
But the point isn't that. The point is
You're saying it's a tenuous link.
Yes.
All right. That's fine. We can have that debate and we can have that argument. We did. Now, when I asked Ralph Northam, though, Governor-elect Northam, who, by the way, let me say again, we're having this conversation, and I appreciate this conversation. I'm rooting for him, and I hope he's a good governor for us. I think he's a good man, and I said that throughout the campaign. But he cast this vote, and to my mind, I would have voted for that ban. And when I asked him if there were a bill that were passed after a city or a county declared itself sanctuary, would he sign it in that instance? I asked him point blank in the third debate. We got to ask each other two different questions. And he wouldn't even say that he would sign it after the fact. Now, a week out from the election, in an interview with the media, he said he would sign that bill should it come to his desk. Mm-hmm. That he reversed himself on his position on the issue.
Yeah.
Because I still to this day believe it's a legitimate issue that when someone casts a vote on the floor of the state Senate, they should be held accountable for that vote. I'm not saying that that vote caused a resurgence in MS-13. I'm saying allowing for that policy would make it harder for us to crack down on MS-13.
I know what you're saying, but I don't know that anybody who saw that ad who had no other information would conclude that you were saying that. They would conclude that somehow what Ralph Northam did was responsible for what MS-13
was
doing.
Well, and if that's the case, and you know, I tried to make it clear in the first debate when Ralph said, when Governor-elect Northam said, we don't have sanctuary cities. I said, that's right. And we won't if I'm governor, because I would sign that bill. You celebrated the veto of that bill. So I wasn't trying to pretend like that was the case. But the ad
certainly was very artfully drawn to leave an impression, as was the third ad that you were criticized for, which is the ad about the bill the policy of the administration to return voting rights to felons who had served their term. And you chose the example of one a person who got their rights back for exactly 4 months, who had been a convicted pedophile, and then committed another crime. And 4 months later, when this was 14 years or 16 years after the original offense, committed another crime and lost the right to vote. Also, it was linked to the right to own guns.
Yes.
And
that's the right that is of most concern.
Right.
Is that and so this person was a convicted pedophile, as you noted, and then had his rights restored after having been arrested again for having one of the largest collections of child pornography in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And my point was and remains, I'm for generous restoration of rights. I don't believe we should punish someone time and time again for a crime they committed once. And if they have paid their debt to society and are living peaceably among us and productive members, we want to welcome them back into society. And I had said that I would have
That's probably the case with most of the people who, I mean, he gave that right back to thousands of people.
Yeah. And I would too. But is there a line you draw where you would have a review? Because what Governor McAuliffe implemented and what then Lieutenant Governor Northam supported and will continue as governor is an automatic blanket restoration of rights, regardless of circumstance. And my point is, are there circumstances where there should be a review before you put someone on a path to getting their gun rights restored? Should you treat a murderer the same as someone who got arrested for cocaine possession? Should you treat a convicted child molester in the review process, or should you have a review process for that, or someone who's committed domestic violence with a weapon, the same as someone who stole an iPhone?
Right.
And I think there should be a line somewhere where there's a review. And that was the point, and that is a policy difference.
But the policy difference, the policy debate is a worthy debate.
Yeah.
Ads, and again, I'm a self-admitted media consultant,
yeah.
past media consultant.
Yeah.
I've made these ads. The impression was that they had basically rearmed and reinvested with rights this pedophile, and the fact is, and he went out and committed more crimes. The fact is that he never voted, and he didn't have, so far as I know, didn't buy a gun.
He pled after, and so he lost his rights again.
Yeah.
But Northam,
who's a pediatric neurologist, I feel affection for him because I have a child with epilepsy, so that's an important thing. Clearly, he is not for arming pedophiles or giving.
No, he's not. But he is for a process that allows for sloppiness and recklessness to occur. And there were many instances, and you know, we chose one. You pick one for an ad, and it exemplifies the risk and the problem of the blanket automatic restoration of rights that he supports, as opposed to a more discretionary approach for certain kinds of felons, nonviolent felons. Frankly, I would support automatic restoration for them. But do you draw a line somewhere and say if someone is a rapist, if someone has committed a violent crime with a gun, do you have a review of their application before there's an approval of putting them on a path to having their gun rights restored? And as I said, I believe and I know him to be a good man, Ralph Northam, and I hope he's an effective governor. But that was a policy difference. And yes, it was an evocative ad to illustrate one of the risks of that policy. But that's, to your point, the nature of campaigns. If I can make one other point about it, David, because you touched on three areas, the statues, MS-13, and restoration of rights. It's important for folks to know, and this is one of the things that happens with media coverage and a narrative gets set. But the fact is, I ran more ads about then-Lieutenant Governor Northam missing important meetings of various panels and commissions on which he served as lieutenant governor, and saying that he shouldn't get promoted if he missed, his attendance was so bad at these meetings. I ran more ads about that than I ran about MS-13 and sanctuary cities combined. I ran more ads on economic opportunity, my tax cut proposal, upward mobility, than on restoration of
How
rights.
How about in the last I eight ran, weeks of the campaign?
I ran more, well, in the last few weeks of the campaign, I ran more ads on education than on statues and closing the education gap. And so, the sanctuary cities, MS-13, I'm pretty sure weren't running at the end of the campaign. It was restoration of rights. And
the pedophile commercial.
Yeah, these are all issues, you know, based on policies and votes cast by my opponent and policy positions taken. But the ads about his missing important votes or missing important meetings as lieutenant governor, the ads about my being for tax cuts and him being against them, the ads about my wanting to close the education gap and his wanting to change the nature of testing as a response to that gap. None of those fit the narrative of the Trump narrative, which is what the media is obsessed with right now. And so if it doesn't fit a narrative of, to your point about Trump-like kind of issues, they don't get written about. I unveiled 21 specific detailed policy proposals in the course of my campaign, including some very innovative criminal justice reforms.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I acknowledge all that, Ed. Yeah. And I know the kind of campaign that you set out to run.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that you were losing, and you torqued up your media in a way that would galvanize your base, which was suspicious of you.
But not just galvanize the base.
I agree with you. You mentioned suburban Republican women
concerns.
Who probably don't like pedophiles with guns
not.
And street gangs. But
right.
But in the end of the day, it kind of spectacularly backfired, didn't it?
Well, I don't know if that – I'll leave that for others to determine
Loudoun County. You carried Loudoun County against Mark Warner in this very close way.
Yeah.
You lost by an ex-urban county outside of Washington, D.C. You lost by 20 points.
Yeah. Less ex-urban than it used to be. It's much more suburban.
Well, and there you go.
Yeah. Well, I also – you know, the fact is if turnout had been normal gubernatorial election turnout – I got more votes for governor than any candidate in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia ever, except for
Ralph Northam, right? Who got
there was an explosion.
He got 300,000 more than McAuliffe. I think you got 100,000.
100,000 more than McAuliffe. And look, there were, you know, we got 65,000 new first time voters for a gubernatorial race, which is pretty big. He got 250,000 first time, and so you can attribute that to those ads. I suspect there are other factors, you know, that come into play. Don't get me wrong. I was the candidate. I take responsibility for the loss. There's a lot of factors, I think.
Let me ask you a question. How much of that leave the tactics aside,
yeah,
that we've beaten to death here, but how much of a factor was Trump himself and people galvanized to send a message to him?
Well, you know, I've seen data in that regard, and I think that was a big factor. I think this is something that folks are going to be sifting through. I take responsibility
for the loss.
Well, if
you're running in 2018, how would you process the Virginia election if you were running in one of these swing congressional districts or in a state?
Well, I would look at the drop off with married women. As you know, a Republican candidate should carry married women at about the same percentage as you carry men as a whole. I think there was about a 9-point differential. You know, that's something that is going to be a challenge if that remains in effect. And, you know, the impact down ballot, obviously. Northern Virginia, it's like a neutron bomb went off and you know, left all the buildings standing, but all the Republican delegates got wiped out.
Yes.
And that's true in the Richmond suburbs as well. And so, I think there are a lot of factors. I would say this to your point about, you know, the appeal of the ads and who I was targeting. The ads were not what you always look for in a campaign is to get your base, but also to appeal to the swing voters. And the data that we had said that the concern about public safety in the Northern Virginia suburbs. Look, the fact is, economically, Virginia's got challenges. You may have just seen the data came out yesterday. We had 4 straight years now where more people moved out of Virginia than into Virginia. That's not the case in Northern Virginia, and it doesn't feel that way here. And so the economy is not a big issue in Northern Virginia in the way it is in Southwest Virginia or Southside or the Northern Neck or even Hampton Roads. The issue that looked like it was going to move voters in the suburbs of Northern Virginia was public safety and a growing concern over that, and that's where we put the focus. Now, clearly it didn't work. Did it create a backlash? I don't think so, but I don't know. And I suspect no matter what ads we ran, that those votes were coming. And
because of Trump.
if you look at the exit data, by 2-1, those who cast a vote based on their perception of the president or were sending a message, it was 2-1 that those who were anti-President Trump came out to vote. So if the exit data is accurate, you know, that that's a factor. I would say too, if you look at, you know, I did pretty well in certain areas where, you know, in certainly in turning out my turnout relative to the president. I also increased my share of the black vote between the, you mentioned the Senate race and the gubernatorial race, from 10% to 12%, which was a focus of my campaign. I wish I'd gotten more. But the turnout was also high amongst African Americans, 20% turnout, which, you know, which is high for a gubernatorial race, a little bit high, not too high. But the turnout in the suburbs and these 250,000 first-time gubernatorial election voters, because of the off-off election year, who voted in a presidential campaign, 250,000 Democrats, only 65,000 Republicans, that to me is a telling number.
I ask you this as someone who likes you and admires you, friend for some time. Back in 2007, 10 years ago, you did an interview and you said, I think the fact is, you know, when a majority of voters aren't with you on an issue, if you don't believe in it, you shouldn't espouse it. And I always say it's better. The best thing in politics is to run as who you are and the, on the things that you believe in and win. And the worst thing in politics is to run as who you're not and things and on things you don't believe in and lose. In reflecting, I mean, you've given a spirited defense for the things that you've done. Do you think back and say, gee, I wish I hadn't have done this or I wish I hadn't have done that? I don't think I was true to myself here.
I did not take positions that I do not believe in. You know, so on immigration, I think there's a big difference between sanctuary cities and the Dreamers. I'm not for deporting the Dreamers, and I made that clear. And I know we can be a welcoming commonwealth and a welcoming country, and I don't think that these people should be punished for decisions made by their parents. Like I said, my father was brought here when he was 8 years old. He didn't make that decision.
Of course.
But at the same time, I don't think we should have sanctuary cities. That's my position. I don't believe that you know, it's the right use of local taxpayer dollars to spend the money to take down the Civil War statues all across the Commonwealth. And by the way, there's hundreds of them. It's not just the ones in Richmond, but there's hundreds of them. And I would rather they be put in historic context and that we erect new statues when where we've been on the right side of history. Doug Wilder is the first African-American governor elected in the history of the country. We should have a statue to Doug Wilder in Richmond. We should Dred Scott and Booker T. Washington, Virginians. We should have statues to them. That's what I feel like, but I don't think that we should have the cities spend the money to take down the statues. That's what I feel. And on restoration of rights, I know we can be compassionate, but at the same time, discretionary. Now, are those the issues that I would have chosen to run on as opposed to the tax cuts and you know, and frankly, you know, even the criminal justice reform innovative proposals I put forward in that regard? I, you know, that's where I'd, you know, rather the race have been about, but it, what those weren't what was indicating we're going to move numbers and help
and
you win.
And has the president created an environment in which it's harder to run on those issues that you wanted to run on rather than some of these more
a couple things.
Explosive
issues? Yeah, one is those issues have been, you know, they reflect a more polarized environment. I think there's no doubt about that. And does the president contribute to a polarized environment? I think probably. And the other thing is that my bigger concern, David, is it makes it harder to have a discussion about an issue like sanctuary cities. And there is the, you know, the Fox effect to a certain extent. So Fox News talks about sanctuary cities and it gets magnified there. And there's almost this reaction then to marginalize it elsewhere. And it's a legitimate concern in my view. I think we should cooperate with federal authorities, and I'm pro-immigration and the son of an immigrant, and but I don't I think we should enforce the laws. But it does make it harder to have a conversation about those issues. I would say even, you know, on statues, you know, I never talked about defending heritage because that's not how I see the issue or view it. And I see the flag, the Confederate flag, a whole different way than these statues in the, and by the way, so do most Virginians, in our city squares and at the county courthouses. But when the president tweeted about it himself, he tweeted about heritage, and that injected it into the, you know, into the discussion in a way I would not and never did, because to me it's about, you know, are you going to spend the money on you know, bringing down these statues or put them in historical context? That's a better conversation to have around the Commonwealth, and I think would actually be a healthy conversation to have. The conversation about historical context would probably be good for us. But that tweet contributed to the, you know, again, it polarized it even more in an issue that is a 60-30 issue, even in the Washington Post in
Virginia. Is there room for an Ed Gillespie? You know, is there room for the sort of reasonable man in this environment? And are you done with this now? Or are you done with running for public office?
I'm done with running for public office.
Would you encourage others to run for public office, knowing what you know and having gone through what you've gone through?
Probably not.
That's a sad statement coming from a guy who I know is so deeply. I mean, you've spent your life in this democracy.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think that, and look, this gets to a broader discussion too. The way the media world is, there's no, you know, there are no. That's not fair to say there are no. Because the, you know, the nature of the way the race was covered in Northern Virginia versus the rest of the Commonwealth is very, very different. And the way the national media environment and the, you know, they come in and they kind of pick up these issues in a state or in even locality and nationalize them in a way where they don't have the context and they don't have the proper understanding. People outside Virginia would not understand that the statues that people actually care about in Virginia are the ones that are over 100 years old, generally in their town square or at their county courthouse, not Robert E. Lee in Richmond. That's not the one or certainly not in Charlottesville.
But you're saying that isn't.
But that's.
There's no room for nuance.
There's no room for nuance. Mm-hmm. And so everything gets cast in. And, you know, there's. You got to, you know, pick a side and you, you know, the way that people characterize you in the shorthand to get the clicks and that kind of thing, what drives clicks. I mean, you're from the news business originally, and you know it was always the case that the product was not the paper, it was you, and the advertisers, you know, were selling you. Now we're selling clicks, and it has a very debilitating and, I think, cynical and corrosive effect on the ability to have an actual conversation about serious issues. And a lot of times the effect is just to try to shut down the conversation. And I think that's one of the things that I can tell you right now, having run, that is one of the things that energizes that Trump electorate that I know and campaigned with. And I've, you know, one of the, and by the way, the campaign was a great experience. So don't get me wrong. I'm a better person for having done it. I'm a better person for having gone into the coal mines and spent the time with the miners. I'm a better person for having campaigned in public housing communities. I'm a better person for having gone to the Eastern Shore and spent the time with the watermen. But I can tell you that there are a lot of people who feel like they're not just being disagreed with, but they are being disdained, and that their legitimate concerns about certain things are, you know, stifled and diminished and marginalized in a way that frustrates them. To the earlier conversation, I think you see some of that in the debate around Roy Moore and whether or not he wins or loses in Alabama. That will be a significant factor in the mentality there, mm-hmm. Because people feel like they are being marginalized, demonized for having concerns by an elite that doesn't understand their, you know, their concerns. And that's a long answer.
The president certainly understands that, and he is very artful at tapping into it.
Yes, and the media, as much as they kind of hate it, but the, you know, the ratings are good and the clicks are good, and it's, you know, there's a business aspect to it as well, and it is a concern to me. And that's a long answer of saying, if having run a lot of campaigns myself, now two statewide races as a candidate, the atmosphere is definitely different in 17 than it was in 14. There's no two ways about it. It is a much more poisonous atmosphere. And I don't know if there's causality or correlation. I leave that for others to determine. But I could not honestly say to someone that I like and think is a halfway decent human being, yeah, you ought to run for office.
What about you? What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm making up for lost time with my children and enjoying that, and with Kathy. Like I said, we met on a softball field. We've been married 30 years. She was an incredible surrogate on the campaign trail, and we are truly blessed. And I'm blessed. And I'd like to find a way where whatever talents I have and skills that I have, in addition to supporting my family, maybe can help in the not-for-profit sector and help. You know, I'd like to help people help me, but I don't want to, you know, do politics per se, but I'll help people who help me. We've got state Senate races in Virginia mm-hmm. in 19. We've got some congressional seats up this year that are going to be tough for us, and I want to help some folks. But, you know, I've got an opportunity here to, you know, to really think about what is it I want to do and where do I want to try to make a difference for the country I love and the Commonwealth I love. And a lot of the relationships I've made in the course of the past year, I want to maintain and continue, especially in the recovery community, dealing with addiction and recovery mm-hmm. and in addressing the achievement gap between minority students and white students that is way too pronounced.
So you're done with politics, but you're not done with service in some form or fashion.
I hope not. If there's a way, adoption and foster care are areas. So, I made a lot of great friendships and relationships, and that's one of the reasons I'm a better person, even though I lost the race. You get to go places as a candidate that mm-hmm. nobody gets to go. I would not have been in these recovery communities, talking to people dealing with addiction, in the jails. Out on the port with the pilot captains and out, you know, with the oystermen on Tangier Island or in the coal mines. And so, you know, it's transformative in a lot of ways and eye-opening. And I learned to see things from the perspective of different people, and it changed my mind on a lot of things. So I'd, you know, like to keep that going somehow, but without having to be a candidate.
Well, you're going to go through a recovery of an entirely different sort, and I wish you the best of luck with that. And Ed Gillespie, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you for being a board member at the Institute of Politics.
Thank you, David. Thanks for letting me be your 200th podcast.
Yeah.
Congratulations on
thank
that.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
The right sheets can take your sleep and your style to the next level. With Boll & Branch, the upgrade has never been more affordable. Every set is crafted from 100% organic cotton. They get softer and softer over time. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews, and even 3 U.S. presidents have Boll & Branch sheets. Try them for 30 nights, and if you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. Go to BollandBranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free U.S. shipping with promo code AXE, spelled BOLL and Branch.com. That's BollandBranch.com, promo code AXE.